from your word, and we ask that you would shape our wills that we may obey you, and we ask it for your name's sake. Amen. Well, please do sit down. If I said that this morning I'm going to preach a sermon about Christian giving or about the priority of prayer, there's a fair chance that a good number of you would have already switched off and thought about the Sunday lunch, and your attention would certainly be elsewhere. However, if I say that what I'm going to talk about this morning is about how prayers and givers and fasters go to hell, well, it might just make you sit up and listen a little more and take notice. A sermon about how those who can give lots of money, about those who pray lots of prayers, about those who miss lots of meals in their fasting, about how people such as that can go to hell instead of heaven. A sermon about how the most religious person can miss out on the reward of heaven. Well, that's what Jesus is saying in the reading that we had read to us from Matthew chapter 6, and it'd be a help to you and to me if you'd turn to it on page 5 of the New Testament part. That's the back part of the Bibles that you should have near you. Matthew chapter 6. And it's the middle part of the Sermon on the Mount. Just a few weeks ago, the Sunday Telegraph recently ran a feature on preaching. It was a fairly fatuous article, but it did include a preacher's top pop chart. The top 15 preachers in this country. Now, I can only assume that they hadn't heard John's or my tapes, or maybe we just feature at number 16 and 17, but the writer began his article by saying that the Sermon on the Mount was the most impressive sermon ever preached. And I think I'd agree. He went on to say, or she went on to say, that the Sermon on the Mount was the model sermon, and that she'd read it through and it lasted 14 minutes 20 seconds. That seemed to be what made it a model sermon for her. However, what she didn't go on to say was how shocking the Sermon on the Mount really is. And putting it forward as the model sermon without telling us that it contains shocking material and great surprises made me wonder whether she'd really understood it as she'd timed it at 14 minutes 20 seconds. Because look at chapter 6 verse 1, and as I read it I want you to see if you can notice the shock that there is. Beware of practicing your piety before men in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. And notice the shock there of its solemn warning. Beware, it begins. Beware. Jesus is issuing a hazard warning to those who of his followers who are listening to this sermon. Beware. And the warning is about rewards. Jesus is saying that it's possible to miss out on God's rewards. And I take it that means it's possible to miss out on heaven itself. Just flip over a page and you'll see that Jesus goes on and amplifies it even more. Just one page to chapter 7 and verse 21 on page 7. Jesus later on in the Sermon on the Mount goes on to say that not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty wonders in your name? And then will I declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. And not everyone who says, Lord, Lord. That's it, not everyone who does impressively religious things is going to enter heaven. And the opposite of heaven is hell. A couple of weeks back, some friends took me to Windsor Safari Park. And as we drove through the lion's enclosure, so there were plenty of beware signs. Lions eat car tires. Keep moving. Well, here's also a hazard warning. Beware. Well, beware of what? Beware of missing heaven. How? Well, chapter 6, verse 1 doesn't just give us the warning, it gives us the principle as well. And the principle is this: those who practice piety, literally it means those who practice their acts of righteousness, those who perform their religious actions, those who practice piety to be seen by others will not be rewarded by God. But before we examine this principle of private piety a little more closely, I want to make one further introductory comment, and it's this: that there is a public side to Christian discipleship. Just look back a couple of columns to chapter 5 and verse 16, and that makes that absolutely clear for us. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Jesus, at the beginning of this Sermon on the Mount, has declared blessed those who face persecution for Jesus' sake, those who were persecuted on Jesus' account in verse 11. And he goes on to exhort his disciples that they need to be clearly seen as those who will stand for Christ, despite persecution, despite suffering. They're not to hide away, they're not to become invisible, especially in the areas of morality that then take up the rest of the chapter. Our Christians are to be seen, but we're to be seen in order that people might give glory to God. Chapter 5, verse 16. So is Jesus contradicting himself here in chapter 6 and verse 1 with this warning that we shouldn't be seen? No. No. The challenge certainly is in chapter 5 to be distinctively Christian in the world. The standard is to work at perfection, as chapter 5 verse 48 gives us, the standard, which is God himself. But here in chapter 6 verse 1, Jesus is saying is that it's possible to negate our witness, it's possible to blow our witness, and to render it all useless. Now, there's no mandate here for a totally private, personal Christianity. Jesus doesn't condone the idea that some people have that Christianity is a private matter. It's between me and God. Now, Christianity in Matthew chapter 5 is public, and our good works are to be seen by the non-Christian. We are to so let our light shine before men. But good things, for wrong reasons, cease to be good things. Good things, for wrong reasons, cease to be good things. The warning of chapter 6 verse 1 is that it's possible to muddle up what ought to be public and what ought to be private. What, in fact, must be public, that is, the fact that we are Christian and our public standards of morality set by God himself. That should be public. But it's possible to confuse it with what should be private, that is our acts of religion, our piety, to get them mixed up, and Jesus says, beware. So in verse 1 here, we have a warning and a principle. And then that's illustrated by Jesus in verses 2 to 18, the rest of our reading. Jesus takes three common first century religious actions, in fact common religious actions to just about every world religion, and he shows how dangerous it is to be public where we should be private. In chapter 6, verse 1, Jesus exposes false piety in order to encourage true piety. And then this same pattern, the exposure of false piety and the encouragement of true piety, runs right the way through each of these three illustrations. It's the same structure that runs through three illustrations. Illustration about giving in verses 2 to 4. An illustration about praying in verses 5 to 15, and an illustration about fasting in verses 16 to 18. Three very common first century acts of piety: giving, praying, and fasting. And Jesus exposes with these three illustrations, exposes false piety in order to encourage true piety, and he does it by means of contrasts. And there are two contrasts I want to draw your attention to in this verse 1 and in the three illustrations. First, a contrast in motives. A contrast in motives. The great distinguishing mark of false piety is why it's done, is its motive. The motive in chapter 5 for being visible lights, to be seen as Christians, is to bring glory to God, that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Notice in verse 1 of chapter 6 that the motive here is quite the opposite. The audience being seen by men is identical. But now the motive is quite different. Now the motive, not done for the benefit of God, but done for the benefit of self. And Jesus graphically illustrates it with these three acts of giving and praying and fasting. And isn't it fascinating that it's at these points, at our very religious acts, that our motives can get so mixed up, that our motives can lead us astray, that we'll want people to see that we're religious. And this wanting to be seen by people as religious, well, it's called hypocrisy. So in verse 2, we're not to be like the hypocrites. Or verse 5, we're not to be like the hypocrites. Verse 16, we're not to be like the hypocrites. The hypocrite? Well, the hypocrite whose motive for religious action is to be praised by other people. It literally means play acting. The word hypocrite means to wear a mask. It's a word borrowed from the theatre world of the first century, where they used to perform with masks in front of their faces that they held in their hand. They held a mask in front of their face in order to pretend to be someone else. Now, the person whose motive is to be seen is literally that, is play acting, playing the part. They're going through the right motions so others will think of him as something. Oh, think of them as a very religious person, when in fact they're nothing of the kind. Because it's all false. It's all make-believe religion. A hypocrite, person acting the part, wanting to be noticed. I suppose we call it stage-managed religion. So in verse 2, in Jesus' illustrations, in verse 2, the hypocrite, well, he's the play actor with trumpeted giving. In verse 5a, the hypocrite, the play actor, has street corner praying. And in verse 16, the hypocrite has glum-faced fasting. What do they mean? Trumpeted giving? Well, it may well be that the collection bowl in the temple was a trumpet shape made of metal, and as the person placed their coin in the collection basket, so it made a noise. And the hypocrite would toss it in from some distance to make sure it made the greatest noise so that the most people heard. A street corner praying? Well, you see, if you pray on a street corner, the people in two roads can see that you're praying. Maximizes the effect. The glum-faced fasting, well, it's like the person who's on a diet. You know, where's the glum face so that everybody knows exactly what's going on? Well, the hypocrite. The hypocrite makes sure they have an audience and therefore is ostentatious in performing their religion. Now, notice here that Jesus is not saying that giving, you'll be pleased to hear this, Keith, he's our treasurer, that giving and praying and fasting are wrong. No, they're not wrong. Each time Jesus doesn't say, if you do these things, he says, but when you do these things, there's a clear expectation that people will give and will pray and will fast. There's no hint that we shouldn't do those things, but that we should question our motive. We should question our motive. Neither is Jesus saying that when people happen to see us doing these things, it's wrong. Because there's a huge difference between wanting to be seen and just happening to be seen. My father, when he was younger, was very active in local politics all through the time when we as children were growing up, and he'd often have to go out in the evenings, at weekends, to political functions. And we as kids would say, why are you going, Daddy? Oh, just to show my face. was his most common reply. They're going to be seen. Well, Jesus isn't here banishing prayer meetings, for example. The rest of the New Testament encourages them, and therefore we ought to be coming to the prayer supper tomorrow week. But the person who comes to the prayer supper in order to be seen by other people, whose motive is to be noticed, well, that person perhaps ought not to come to the prayer supper tomorrow week. You see, the person who covenants their giving, and you ought to be doing that because it's the most tax-efficient way, that is what you wanted me to say, Keith, yes? Yes, quite right. Well, the person who covenants their giving, you can't get round at least one person knowing that you do that. Now, nobody else, in fact, does know. But it can't be helped sometimes from people seeing. And I guess for those of us who are married or those who share flats with people, it's inevitable that the people you live with, that they'll know that you read the Bible, they'll know that you pray. It's impossible for Joe and I to not know when each other's praying. But do we do it to impress each other? Ah, there's a contrast in motives going on here. False piety is driven by people. It's driven by wanting people to see us. And the power of people is very great, isn't it? It is great. You see, I do want people to see me, because what people think of me is very important to me. It's an almost universal human desire, isn't it, that we want people to think well of us? And we teach it to our children from the veriest earliest age. We teach them to please us. It's very easy for that for them when they grow up, that they'll want to be well thought of by people, and it's very easy for that to become the motivating force for our action, even in the religious sphere. That we do things so people will notice, so that people will see. And the warning of verse 1 here is that if that's what motivates us, it leads to sham discipleship. That where what should be unselfish by definition, in fact, becomes self-absorbed. So giving is towards others, but it can be done in such a way that, in fact, it's me who it's done for. Praying is directed towards God, but it can be done for self when it's such that people will see us. False piety is motivated by self, wanting to be seen by other people. And we have these three illustrations here from Jesus of giving and praying and fasting. But perhaps we ought to widen the principle and make our own illustrations. It's very easy to make our other religious actions, our other religious activity. So, the acts of service that we do in the church family here at St. Helens. Very easy to have to be noticed by people. When Trivial Pursuit, our mission outreach, comes up in the end of February. Very easy for our bringing of friends to that, to have to be noticed by other people. Very easy for our attendance at fellowship group or at a Read, Mark, Learn group to be driven really by wanting people to see that we're there, wanting to be seen so that we'll be well thought of. Wanting to be seen because we want people to think we're keen as Christians. We don't want people to think that we might be, well, falling away a bit. Now, I take it that Jesus spends these first 18 verses here of chapter 6 of his most famous sermon. That is something like 3 minutes of the 14 minutes, 20 seconds of this sermon. That he takes time because of the possibility of fraudulent religious practice. It's going to be a real pressure on us. Let me say, we may be a little more subtle. We may be a little more subtle than the trumpet blaster, the street corner prayer, or the glum-faced faster. And we may be better actors, but very often the motive is still the same. And it's even possible for us to do the allowing it to be seen by getting our partners to let it be known. And we can be very subtle indeed. I remember once when I was at college receiving a check through the post, and the person who'd sent the check had gone to great lengths to make it anonymous, or so I'd thought. It was a typewritten envelope, and the check inside was drawn on a building society account, so there was no way I could know who the payee was. And I decided that I'd respect that person's anonymity and not make any effort to find out who it was. The trouble was, the person who'd sent the check made it very plain over the next week exactly who it was who'd sent it. They kept dropping all sorts of little hints about whether I'd received any checks recently. Not so subtle. That has to be seen. That's false piety. And that in contrast to true piety. Because true piety is not motivated by an audience, but is motivated by a relationship. Now notice the phrase in chapter 6, verse 1. There'll be no reward from our Father, your Father, in heaven. And in Jesus' three illustrations, that negative of verse 1 is put positively. So in verse 4, it's when you give secretly, your Father sees. Or verse 6, it's your Father who sees your secret prayer. Or verse 18, it's your Father who sees. Actually, the motive that will cause us to give generously, to pray regularly, and to discipline ourselves, whether it's in fasting of food or fasting in other sorts of ways, perhaps television and the way we spend our time, the motive for those sorts of things, the motive for our religious activity is our relationship with the Father. And right through the Sermon on the Mount, that has been the striking way that God has been described for these followers of Jesus, their Father in heaven. And so that's how we address him in the prayer that we prayed earlier that's recorded here in verse 9, our Father in heaven. It's the language of genuine relationship between ourselves and God. Now we'll practice our piety, not for the praise of men, but content that our Father sees. No one need know what we do, because our Father sees. It's done as the right expression of being God's children, being in relationship with him. And if I'm not secure in my relationship with God the Father, then it seems to me very likely that we'll be insecure in our relationships with other people, and will desperately need their affirmation and go out of our way to receive their praise. A right relationship with God here is the liberator from the slavery of having to please men. Let me say that again. I think that's the shocking thing. Right relationship with God is the liberator from the slavery of having to please men. Now, contrast in motives. What motivates you? Now, be warned, verse 1, of practicing your piety in order to be seen by men. The true story has been told, and it only came out years after it happened, of when Maurice Wood was principal at Oak Hill Theological College. And while he was principal, one of the cleaners had to leave the staff. And so it was put to the student body by the bursar at Oak Hill that the students in rotation could do some of the cleaning, which involved cleaning the lavatories. And the student committee decided that that was well below them, and after all, they paid their fees to have cleaners to do such things, so they weren't going to do it. And so they didn't. And it was only years afterwards, after Maurice Wood left Oak Hill, that the identity of the person who had cleaned the toilets became known. And that Maurice Wood had got up at 6 o'clock every morning for over 2 terms to clean the toilets himself. Not wanting to be seen. Not needing to be seen. You see the contrast in motives? And then secondly, and slightly more briefly, the contrast in rewards. Verse 1 again. For if you practice your piety to be seen by men, you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Now notice, interestingly, Jesus is not saying that there is no reward at all for the hypocrite. Now, there is reward for the hypocrite. And in these three illustrations, Jesus makes it clear that there is reward. There's a very real reward. but it is very limited. Look at verse 2. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. Or again in verse 5, they have received their reward. Or again verse 16, the same phrase, they have received their reward. The investment of giving and praying and fasting, the investment of religious practice is a short-term policy with profits now, if the motive is to be seen. It's cash on delivery. The reward is immediate. My motive may be to receive people's praise, for people to think of me as a keen Christian, for people to be impressed by what I do, but that will be the limit of the reward I receive. The most very ostentatious person receives exactly what they set out to achieve, that they'll be well thought of. And people do think well, I suppose, of religious people. The person who gives a lot, the benefactor whose name's at the back, is at the back of the theatre programme. Yeah, think a lot of them. That's all the reward they'll get, their name at the back of a theatre programme. It's staggering that such a short-term reward can be such a powerful motivating force, isn't it? That the praise of man will cause us to do religious acts that do nothing in the eyes of God. And notice the negative of verse 1. It is a very limited reward that is immediate in its gaining of kudos with others, but it merits no reward from God. And I take it that no reward from God means that it's giving him certainly no pleasure. It's useless, except for a transient top-up for our pride. So why is it? Why is it that something as bankrupt as this hypocrisy is so powerful in its motivation? Because if we can answer that, then perhaps we're some way to stop investing in something with no future profits. Why is it so powerful? Well, first, as we've indicated already, because it's self-driven. We get something out of it. We'll be praised by men. But I think, second, one of the reasons it's so powerful is because the reward is visible and now. You see, the contrast in the rewards is that the reward for private piety in these three illustrations, the person who gives in verse 3 so that their left hand doesn't even know what their right hand is doing, the reward for the person in verse 4 is that your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And it's the same with the prayer illustration in verse 6. It's the same with the fasting illustration in verse 18. The Father will reward. You see, the rewards for true piety, the rewards for this private piety, are certain. But seen in their context here of Matthew chapter 6, they're largely future, in contrast to the reward of now that false piety receives. We tend to think, don't we, that the now generation is a 20th century malaise. You know, the desire to receive, the desire to experience in the present rather than the future is somehow the pressure that suddenly has come upon our generation, that something that's been created by the TV advertising age. In fact, the desire to receive now and experience now rather than wait for the future is as old as the Sermon on the Mount, and even older, of course. Now, right through chapter 6 here, as we're going to see next week as we study the second half of the chapter, we're going to see that the push on us is to live for now and take the rewards now. Take that which is immediate and miss out on what is future. We'd rather take the immediate and the visible and the now rather than the future. It's a reward limited to the praise of men when it's false party, and it's exclusive to that. It receives no reward from God. And yet that is the reward, to be rewarded by our Father in heaven. That is the reward in this chapter that's worth having. That's the reward that Jesus is encouraging us to want. The contrast in rewards, rewarded by man's praise now or rewarded by our Father in heaven. The person who gives, the person who prays, the person who has their quiet time, the person who's serving, that person will certainly be content to do it as an expression of their relationship of God. They'll do it privately. They'll do it without drawing attention to themselves. They'll do it as an expression of relationship, and they'll go on doing it in faith. For notice, it must take faith here in this relationship to keep on. To keep on when there may be no reward now. Faith to believe that God can see what we do when no one else does. Faith to believe that he will reward. Now you have to trust that God will do that. It requires real relationship with God. It requires real faith in God to sustain. The rewards, they're such a contrast. From men or God? From now or heaven? Well, tantalizingly, the passage doesn't tell us exactly what the rewards for the properly private disciple are. Instead, it just leaves us most forcibly with the contrast. For some, there will be no reward from God, but for others, there will be reward from God. For those whose relationship with God is a sham, and in fact, there is no relationship, there's no faith in him, well, there'll be no reward from him. And I take it from chapter 7, as we looked earlier, that means that even these religious people will be banished from God's presence for eternity. Now, the major push in this context is to show that there are no rewards from God for the hypocrite. And so it must be a warning, this chapter, a warning to the hypocrite that they will have no place in heaven. That certainly comes through all three of the illustrations. However, verse 1 does seem to me to be a warning for the Christian. It's a warning for those of us who are genuinely in relationship with God. It's a warning for those of us who are genuinely God's children, such that we describe him as our Father in heaven. It's a warning to them, to us. It's a warning to us that our religious activity can be emptied by false piety. Now, we're not told what the rewards are for the Christian who doesn't pray to the gallery, but rather is private. It's certainly not that they're going to be meritorious, but rather there'll be appropriate results for what we do. But what we are told here is that what we do now, and the way we do it now, will be significant for eternity. God rewards it. It meets his approval. It meets his acceptance. And I think that therefore should guard us from the temptation to the rewards of the praise of man. A false piety or true piety? Our false piety here is exposed wide open, and the push will be on us to go that way. False piety, it's motivated by the wrong audience, wanting to be seen by men. And it's rewarded now. Rewarded now by man's praise, but rewarded with nothing from God. That must be the warning for the non-Christian hypocrite, a warning of eternal separation from God. And it must be the warning for the genuine Christian, that our religious acts can be emptied of eternal significance. False piety, it's exposed, but true piety is encouraged. Encouraged because it's motivated by the right audience, a private audience with the Father, motivated by a relationship with him, motivated by that and rewarded, our Father in heaven, who sees what you do, will reward you. Well, let's pray together as we remain seated. Well, why don't we have a moment or two of quiet and use it as an opportunity to ask ourselves the question, where is the pressure on us to do things for the praise of men, in what ways do our religious acts, in what ways are they done so that people see, and it'd be appropriate in the silence to repent of that and ask that God would so make our relationship with Him secure that we'd be content to do them, trusting that He sees and trusting that He rewards. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer.